We're going to be in John chapter 2, so if you would like to turn there, we'll just kind of try to make a few points that I think are pretty significant. Very interesting section here for a number of reasons, and not the least of which is this is the only time that, let me say it a different way. John has put the cleansing of the temple at the beginning of Jesus' ministry. It's very possible Jesus did it twice. My own belief is that John places it here rather to make a theological point. So we're not going to worry about whether or not it was once, twice, or whatever. But either way, the setting is exactly the same. The setting is during the Passover. Remember also that John, when he writes, he wants to bring people to faith. He makes that very clear to us in John chapter 20, verses 30 through 31. He sums up all he said and he says, you know, I'm just trying to get you to believe, and by believing you may have life in his name. That's his point. Everything he says is leading us to that. Everything he says tries to affirm that very point. And so it's important for John, perhaps, to make theological points that his disciples would, be stronger in their faith, or that others would come to faith as a result. He describes the events in Jesus' life with an eye to what he did, as well as an eye to what the church believed at the time of its writing. You have to remember, all these things are written after the fact, after all this took place. And so the writer is kind of looking down on this from a narrative point of view, and he's saying, okay, here's what happened. And it's interesting, in this particular passage, he makes a point of saying, well, his disciples remembered something later on. Both in verse 17, his disciples remembered, and also in verse 22, his disciples remembered. So he's kind of giving us a sense of, you know, all right, I'm telling you all this, but I'm also telling you what the disciples got out of it later on. They may not have gotten it at the beginning when it was happening, but they got something out of it later on. And so we're going to look at this passage today and see, all right, what can we get out of it? What does the church learn from this even today? What are the lessons we get? There's kind of several phases of what happens here. The very first one is Jesus disrupts the temple activities. And I use that word on purpose. This was extremely disruptive, what Jesus did. And those who experienced it recognized just how disruptive it was. He used the whip. Verse 15, he used a whip. Think about that. He's running around the temple area and he's beating people with a whip of cords. He overturned tables and drove out animals. His disciples were no doubt, I'm guessing, a little bit dumbfounded watching his, and I'm going to use another very strong word that I think is right, rampage. One of the things that I remembered, if any of you saw the Bible that was out in the movie of not too long ago, Roma Downey and Mark Burnett produced that. It was actually pretty good. But this one scene, Janet and I both felt like it was too mild. Okay, when they portrayed Jesus in the temple, it was like, well, he just kind of did a few things and kind of got a little people upset. I'm sorry, this was a rampage. This was extremely disruptive. He was angry at what he saw going on in the temple. The merchants, I'm guessing, were really perplexed and like, who is this guy? And what is he doing? They were the objects of his wrath, were they not? You've made my place, you've made my father's house a place of business or a place of trade. Actually, I believe in some translation he says a den of thieves. He knew what was going on there, okay? The authorities who experienced it were incensed. How dare he come in here into our place? We're the authorities here. How dare he come in here and disrupt things like this? I can only imagine people going home later on and talking about, whoa, you know what happened at the temple today? Sitting around their tables. Well, you know, this is one of those situations the disciples would reflect on later on, and it says very clearly by John, his disciples remembered something And what they remembered was Psalm 69 and verse 9, that zeal for my Father's house will consume me. And think about that word consumed. He was overwhelmed with what he saw going on. And that's why I say what he did was really, really disruptive. He would have looked, I think, to most people like he was just out of control. Take it easy, Jesus. This really isn't as bad as it looks. Yes, it was. I mean, that's what he would answer to them. Hey, this is worse than you think it is. Let's not go into this, how bad this was. This was horrible. You've turned my Father's house into a den of thieves. You've perverted what the house was all about. Jesus is trying to remind them of the real purpose for the house, and he comes in and he cleans house in a very real sense. The theological lesson for the church, I think, is pretty simple. If you go back to 1 Kings chapter 8, verses 27 through 53, you will read Solomon's dedication of the temple. And Solomon goes through a litany of the kind of things that the temple is for, and they all relate to coming to God in prayer. He relates various situations, when famine hits, when our people are accosted by enemies, when somebody who's on a foreign soil gets into trouble, and all kinds of different things. Even when an alien comes and he comes to you to pray to this house, Lord, hear their prayers. This was a place to commune with God. This was a place to offer sacrifices for sin. This was a place that God came down and said, here's where you'll find me. That was the purpose of that temple mount, of that place. And there's just so many other places in the Old Testament, in the law and so forth, that was a place to commune with God. It was his presence. It represented his presence. In Jeremiah chapter 7, verses 1 through 15, Jeremiah kind of has the same problem that Jesus had here. Jeremiah stands in the temple and he says, guys, don't stand here and act like God's not going to hurt or do anything to you because you have the temple. When in fact, all you do is you come here, you offer sacrifices, and you go out of the temple and you do whatever you want. I'm paraphrasing what Jeremiah said, but that's essentially his message. They were trusting that they had the temple, but they were not doing anything to respond to what the temple represented. I don't know if there was buying and selling going on at the temple at the time, but I know that Jeremiah sees their hypocrisy. And he says, you know, this isn't going to work. You guys can't just use the temple to hide the fact that you're not obeying God one iota. It's just a ritual that you're going through. And of course, the buying and selling of the temple in John demonstrates the people have once again failed to see the real purpose of God. They've made it to benefit themselves. It has not become a place where people come to commune with God. They've kind of kept a little bit of that in mind, but it's more like, hey, how can we profit from this? And so Jesus disrupts their activities, and he says, no more of this. Well, the next phase of this is the fact that the Jews, the leaders of the people, they remember, they're probably very incensed that they have been upstaged. So they come to Jesus and they say, I want you to show us a sign as to why you do this. In the other accounts, in Matthew and in all the other three Gospels, we don't have this questioning for a sign. But at some point, they ask him, by what authority are you doing these things? And in Matthew and Mark, the question of authority does not follow directly from the temple cleansing. It comes a little bit later. He's cleansed the temple. Jesus has spent time in the temple teaching and preaching. Remember, this Matthew and Mark and Luke, it's all at the end of his ministry. It may be the same incident here, but John's using it differently. The fact is, they question his authority. In Luke just says, one day, Jesus, you know, one day they asked him. We don't know what day it was. We don't know if it came directly after the cleansing or just what. We don't really know. But we know they asked him. I kind of feel like here, them asking him for a sign is probably very similar to them asking for his authority to do these things. Remember that Paul will say very clearly the Jews ask for signs. That was important to them. The prophets often gave them signs. Moses gave them signs. Okay, there were all kinds of things that they could see, these miraculous things that they did, either Moses did or the prophets did, that gave them a sign. And by the way, if you go back and you look at those times, like in Elijah and Elisha, The signs really didn't make that much of a difference anyway. It didn't really turn the people's hearts. It just said, okay, God's speaking to you. It didn't necessarily make a difference in their lives. My guess is it wasn't going to make a difference in the lives of these people. They just wanted proof. They wanted to challenge Jesus' authority. And so they ask him to justify his actions. You know, what did the church think about this question? Or let's say, what did the disciples think about this question? I kind of wonder if maybe the disciples watching all this, maybe they were just kind of curious to hear what he was going to say. Well, Jesus, you know, we believe you're the Messiah. What are you going to tell them here about why you're doing what you're doing? So maybe they kind of anxiously awaited the answer. And you'll notice, if you read through the Gospel of John, John uses this word signs very specifically. They are signposts. They are things that indicate that Jesus is somebody particularly special. He uses them to indicate Jesus is the Messiah, of course. But he uses signs very much this way. And I think this becomes one of John's big theological points. Remember, John's not necessarily writing a chronological approach to Jesus. He's writing a theological approach. Well, they all are, but John seems more specifically that. Okay, he doesn't care as much about the chronology of events as much as he cares about the meaning invested in each event. So he uses this idea of signs very specifically, and he lists them numerous times. He's already listed one in this chapter. In chapter 2 and verse 11, after he has changed the water to wine, it says, "This, the first of his signs, Jesus did in Cana in Galilee, and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him." So John's very concerned to say, look guys, think about the things Jesus did. Look at these signs. He doesn't give all the miracles. He gives a couple of them and expands on them. And he kind of gives us the meaning behind a lot of these miracles. And he gives a lot of discussion that goes on when Jesus does the miracles. And it's very much all a part of his idea that I'm going to try to produce faith in my listeners. And all these signs are pretty good markers that Jesus was something special. And yet at times Jesus will often say, will he not, an evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign? I don't know, maybe that's a little confusing to us, but maybe it's the coming to Jesus to say, look, you got to prove yourself first. When in fact Jesus gave plenty of signs, but I think for this group, there probably wasn't ever enough that Jesus could do to prove that he had the authority to do what he did. And if you remember in Matthew and Mark and Luke, he challenges them and says, okay, well, tell me about, what do you think about John's authority? They wouldn't answer. He says, okay, well, I'm not going to tell you about mine either. Basically, he's saying to them, look, you guys aren't going to get it. You really don't want to know what it is, okay? Some signs will never be enough for some people. However, does not Jesus give a sign here? And it's probably the one that's perplexing to them. Destroy this temple, and I'll rebuild it in 3 days. It's a rather mysterious statement at the time. Destroy this temple and build it in 3 days. What did the people think? Well, it's taken 46 years to build this temple. How are you going to rebuild it in 3 days? But, you see, here's another case the disciples remembered. John is telling us that at the time, probably the disciples didn't get it either. But later on, they kind of pieced everything together. And suddenly it was, yeah, okay, the disciples remembered that. And afterwards, they knew what he was talking about. Jesus is referring to his resurrection. It's the one sign that he has promised that the Pharisees, that everybody is going to get. And that's the sign of Jonah. He's going to be in the earth for 3 days, but he's going to come back. That was the one sign that should have been enough for everybody. And if we don't get the resurrection, you know, what else can anybody do for you? And I don't say that to be smart alecky or to kind of throw it in anybody's face, but it's, I don't know, it's just a pretty good sign, if you ask me. Guy comes back from the dead after being in the tomb for 3 days. That's a pretty good sign. By the time John writes this, we also have to remember the temple was gone. John is writing probably later in the first century, after around 60-some AD when the temple was destroyed. He's writing after that. So they all know by this time. The church knows the temple is gone by this time, at the time of John's writing this. But the church is being reminded that it is the resurrection that gives them their hope, not the presence of the temple anymore. There was a time that that was important, that served its function, and it wasn't important that the temple was going to be rebuilt because Jesus had rebuilt his own temple. Through the resurrection, his body had come back. And that's what gave the disciples hope. And that's what they remembered. And you see, one of the things that's happening here also is John's giving us a clue as to what Jesus is going to do through the rest of the book. One of the things that we see John doing, I've mentioned this a number of times, John contrasts the spiritual and the physical a number of times, or he shows that Jesus contrasted any number of times throughout here. When Nicodemus comes to Jesus and he talks to him about the new birth, Nicodemus thinks physical birth. How can a man be born again? Jesus is trying to point out something much deeper to him in that he's talking about a spiritual rebirth. When he talks to the woman at the well, she asks him about, or he asks her for a drink. He says, well, if you knew who was talking to you, you'd ask me for a drink because I can give you living water. She says, well, give me this living water. That way I won't have to keep coming here every day. And Jesus is talking about spiritual water. She's talking about literally coming to the well every day, so she wouldn't have to do that. You see, they're kind of on two different planes. I think Jesus is doing a little bit of that here. He's talking about something spiritual. He's talking about physically his body, but he's talking about a resurrection. He's talking about a spiritual renewal that has nothing to do with the physical temple. It's what Jesus is going to do for them. And that's what his disciples remembered. There was a spiritual rebirth here that was extremely significant. The authorities certainly don't get the reference. I don't think the disciples did at this point either. I think when he says, destroy this temple and I'll rebuild it in 3 days, they were as perplexed as anybody else. We don't get them asking any questions about it. We do know that in the Gospel of Mark in particular, Mark makes the point that Jesus kept trying to tell him he was going to die, that he was going to suffer, and he was going to come back on the third day, and it was like, phew, just went over their heads. You know, they didn't get it. And you and I wouldn't have gotten it either. Okay? We wouldn't have gotten this resurrection thing either. But that's the point Jesus is trying to make here. And his disciples remembered it later. That that's what was going to happen. They could see that it had happened. John speaks for them in verses 21 and 22. He was speaking about the temple of his body. When therefore he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the word that Jesus had spoken. So the saying finally makes sense to them. And the point here is the resurrection really changed everything for them. It gave them the perspective to look back on all that Jesus said and did, and suddenly, okay, that's what this was all about. They were surprised. Any number of them were surprised when it happened. They were surprised when they went to the tomb. They were surprised on the road to Emmaus. They were surprised. But it was the resurrection, you see, that really changed everything for them. So my encouragement today is simply, let's not miss John's points here as well for us today. Jesus' zeal for the temple fulfills a prediction that the Messiah will keep God's purposes in mind and cleanse all of our false attempts to serve him. And even our false attempts to pervert what God has done for us and has purposed for humanity. Jesus' zeal comes to us and says, be careful, serve God properly. We also know that the resurrection now transcends our need for a particular place of worship. Jesus' temple that he refers to was his own body. He died, he came back. That's what gives us hope. Not that we come to a particular place, not that, you know, we meet God in a particular place. We meet God in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Don't miss John's point here. We are called now to worship in spirit and in truth. John chapter 4 and verse 23. Jesus will make that same point a little bit later on. And so my encouragement is simply worship and continue to worship God through our devotion to his Son. Remember his zeal and remember the resurrection.